from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our next hour, there is no group of Americans more pessimistic than working-class whites. So writes author J.D. Vance in his new memoir, Hillbilly Elegy. Born into a Scots-Irish family in rural Kentucky, Vance describes the economic anxiety, familial dysfunction, and disaffection that characterizes today's poor white Americans. We'll talk to him about his memoir, we'll hear his thoughts on why Trump appeals to low-income whites, and we'll learn about his journey from Appalachia to the Rust Belt to Silicon Valley. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Bay Area-based and Yale Law School graduate J.D. Vance is a principal at a leading Silicon Valley investment firm. Far from his roots as a child of Appalachian poverty, growing up in eastern Kentucky and the Rust Belt city of Middletown, Ohio. His new book is Hillbilly Elegy, and he has written a memoir of his family and community and what he describes as a culture in crisis. And we welcome him to the Forum program. Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
I guess I'd like to begin by just reading something you wrote early on here in the book when you say, in our race-conscious society, our vocabulary often extends no further than the color of someone's skin, black people, Asians, white privilege. Sometimes these broad categories are useful, but to understand my story, you have to delve into the details. I may be white, but I do not identify with the WASPs of the Northeast. Instead, I identify with the millions of working-class white Americans of Scots-Irish descent who have no college degree. To these folks, poverty is the family tradition. Their ancestors were day laborers in the southern slave economy, sharecroppers, after that, coal miners, after that, and machinists and mill workers during more recent times. Americans call them hillbillies, rednecks, or white trash. I call them neighbors, friends, and family. And there you have it in a nutshell. It is very moving and poignant writing because it gets to the heart of your experience. It's an experience that takes you and your family from, as I said, well, what we would call the hill people, eastern Kentucky, really Jackson, Kentucky specifically, to an economy that was supposed to be on the way up but wound up hemorrhaging jobs and not really providing the American dream it was supposed to. It's poverty, it's drug use, it's social isolation.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. My grandparents, it's amazing to think back on how optimistic my grandparents were about their children's future and their grandchildren's future. But of course, as I write in the book, that optimism didn't necessarily pan out. Things didn't turn out, I think, as my grandparents and their generation had hoped. That area is like you said, it's feeling isolated and it's feeling especially hopeless.
Well, it was the idea that after the Second World War, when all that prosperity was suddenly ushered in, intergenerational family poverty, particularly like the kind you experienced and your family experienced, was supposed to end.
Yeah, absolutely. It's amazing to think that my grandparents, who neither of whom graduated from high school, my grandma was pregnant at 14 when they moved north from eastern Kentucky to southern Ohio, they were able to earn a middle-class wage for most of my grandparents' lives. What they expected, of course, is that would continue, that their children would be able to do maybe a little bit better than they had done, and that their grandchildren would do even better. But of course, that didn't materialize as these economies and these manufacturing industries started to decline. A lot of the optimism and the hope they had for the future that it appeared very well placed when they were 20, 30, 40, it really evaporated.
This is a book that's dedicated to your grandparents. You call them the Terminators, and we might want to gloss that a bit. But the fact of the matter is you also say about your mamaw.
That's right. That's right.
Your grandmother was known as Mama, a lunatic that everybody would be afraid of. I mean, there's kind of tough. Again, it's that Scots-Irish ancestry that you take pride in, as well as really recognizing the kind of challenges these folks had. But you call yourself one lucky SOB because you had people who love you, and it comes across very profoundly in this book.
Absolutely. It's you know, you mentioned my grandparents were definitely violent in some ways. They didn't adjust to middle class Southern Ohio life in quite the way that they expected.
Neither did I, by the way, but that's another story.
And they were definitely perceived as outsiders because of it. There's a lot of really interesting anthropological studies that my grandparents' experience was pretty broadly shared of these folks who came from very impoverished conditions in eastern Kentucky. They brought their culture and their habits with them, and then they landed in these relatively middle-class, upper-crust cities, and they were supposed to behave a certain way, but of course a lot of them didn't.
Well, you say in the book you were rescued by loving people, even at points where you were nearly giving up on yourself. So again, it becomes really a very powerful story that you have to tell here. But also, you kind of are the American dream. I mean, went to Yale Law School, now working at Silicon Valley Company, obviously doing well for yourself.
Yeah, everything's worked out really well for me. It's been an amazing ride, and I feel incredibly lucky and blessed to have the life that I had. But I really had it because of my grandparents and because of a few other people who came in and made me have opportunities that I wouldn't have otherwise had. We tend to think of the American dream as something where we pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. But as you know, to paraphrase something Thurgood Marshall, I believe, once said, it's not that we're pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps. It's a lot of other people who are pulling for us. And that's certainly the story of my grandparents' lives and my life, is that I was a very frustrated, very resentful, and ultimately a very I was a kid who almost didn't make it. And my grandparents ensured that I did. And that was ultimately why I wrote the book.
You also wrote the book to write about the demons that you still have chasing after you and that are still perhaps a part of, your heritage and what you have inside of your DNA, maybe, too. I mean, there's, you know, toward the end of the book, I want to jump ahead here from where you write about dreams that still haunt you in terms of what you call your demons and so forth. And I didn't have anything like the poverty background you had, but it was a working class background. And as, you know, I kind of moved into what we would call the bourgeoisie, I started having these dreams where I was fighting with myself. You know, I realized it was myself. I was fighting a rich kid. You know, I'm never a rich kid, but you know, that wasn't who I was supposed to be or who you were supposed to be, right? I mean, you were supposed to be part of this poverty generation.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I didn't expect that my life would turn out like it had. And in a lot of ways, I feel a little bit like a foreigner. As much as I appreciate and love the life that I have now, it's a little strange, right? You spend time and you see things that you certainly didn't expect to see. And some of it's, you know, outrageous. Some of it's just relatively tried and normal. Like I go to these nice restaurants and I see all these utensils and I'm not sure how I'm supposed to use them or in what order.
But you didn't even know what a butter knife was, right?
Well, I knew what a butter knife was. I just didn't know that you were supposed to actually use it. It seemed like anything that a butter knife could accomplish, a finger or a spoon could accomplish better. But yeah, a lot of these experiences that I've had, I didn't expect to have. And I think that's part of the story and part of why upward mobility is a little bit more complicated than we think it is that it often takes us from the places that we're most comfortable with and places us in these areas that may be nice and may be lovely, but are still a little foreign.
But those who escaped were mainly those who kind of married outside of the tribe, the region. Yeah,
that's absolutely true. It's primarily what I'm writing about is not just or even primarily an economic problem or an economic issue. I'm talking primarily about folks who live their lives in, you know, relative economic deprivation, but it's fundamentally a sense of social isolation. I think these social problems, the family strife, the addiction, they tend to pass themselves off from one generation to the other. And it's something that a lot of those who you know, from the outside, it looks like we made it out. I think we still struggle with in different ways.
Addiction was a big problem in your family. I mean, throughout this region, opioids, heroin, meth, and so forth. But you tell the story of your mother, and it's again, a very heartrending story.
Yeah, my mom was, as I said in the book, she was the one of my grandparents' children. They had three kids. She was the one who lost the game of statistics. She didn't grow up in a very stable home. It was a very violent home. Her father was an alcoholic. And the statistics tell you that the kids who grow up in those homes are much less likely to make it. And that was definitely the story of my mom's life, is that while her older brother and younger sister did okay, she really struggled with addiction and in some ways still does. It's unfortunate, of course, but it's also one of the things that was great about writing this book, is I started to recognize what I saw previously as just a moral failure, as something that I was very angry at my mother over. I eventually learned that they were much, much more complicated, and in some ways, the life she was living had its roots in decisions that she hadn't made, that her parents had made.
Yeah, but you do come to some political decisions here, I think. I know, would it be apt to say that you would be described politically as conservative.
Yeah, I think that's
fair. I mean,
you've
written for National Review. I guess that's
– Sure.
But you talk about the fact that we created these problems, only we can fix them, and yet you speak about the thumb on the scale, and the thumb on the scale being a way of at least helping people without getting perhaps too much dependent on government or government playing too preeminent a role.
Well, I think it's a recognition that the problems are complex and that government certainly has a role to play, but government probably doesn't have the only role to play. I think just take, for example, the heroin addiction epidemic. If you look at in pure economic terms, the white working class is still doing better than the black and the Hispanic working class in terms of income and wealth, but their kids are much more likely to die of heroin overdoses than black or Hispanic working class kids. And I think that what that suggests is that these problems aren't just economic. And so while there is certainly a role for businesses and better government policy to play, I talk about that a little in the book. I'm also very cognizant that we have to recognize in some ways our own agency and our own complicity in some of these problems. And so it's not an either-or proposition. What I think of it is as a recognition that these problems exist along multiple dimensions, and I'd like for us to think about what we can do better, but I also would like policymakers to think about what they can do better.
We're talking to J.D. Vance. His book is Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis. One of the best examples of that that you tell about in your book is when you were working in a tile factory, putting yourself through law school, and there was a guy who was working there making a pretty good living wage, and yet we go into the bathroom for hours at a time. The boss even hired his wife, who was 5 months pregnant, and gave her a wage. And they were both essentially screw-ups. I mean, they just weren't doing their job. They weren't appearing for their job. They got fired. They blamed the boss.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And if you live in these areas and you see a lot of these problems, you see both these folks types of people, right? So the folks who have a decent job or have access to a decent wage, but simply aren't working that hard, aren't doing a whole lot to support themselves. You also see, of course, the people who are very hardworking, who are trying desperately to get ahead, but can't find a good job. And so there's this weird juxtaposition where you see both sides of this equation. But when you see the folks, when you see the 19-year-old kid who should be working and can work but doesn't, or his 5-month, you know, his pregnant girlfriend who loses her job because she's screwing off. And what really bothered me about that situation is, like you said, when they were fired, they blamed the boss. They acted like something had been done to them. And there's a loss of agency here that I see in a lot of these communities. I see in my community that we're not quite recognizing the role that we have in our own problems, even as we, you know, like I said, should be pushing for better policies, but also should recognize that for at least some of us, we could be doing more.
Chris, when you were a 12-year-old kid, suddenly you had very little agency because your mother acted, shall we say, intemperately, to use an advisable word here. You wind up in court. Caseworkers got involved. You saw them as obstacles to overcome, and you essentially had to prevaricate when you were in court to make sure. I mean, here you are now, an attorney, but had to do that and to make sure that you weren't taken away from your mother.
Yeah, it made me realize that the social welfare bureaucracy, the child welfare system, even though it's very well-meaning, it's built in some ways around a conception of the nuclear family that just wasn't true for my kin. So it wasn't just my mom that played a role in my life. It was my aunt. It was my uncle. It was my—
You were an extended family.
Exactly. It was my grandparents, who, of course, were sort of my saviors. And when the system got a hold of us because my mother had been accused of domestic violence, when the system got a hold of us, I was basically given an option. Look, you can keep on talking, you can keep on complaining about the problems at home. If you do that, you're going to go live with a foster parent. Or if you just shut up and stop talking about it altogether, then you can stay with your family. And it creates this really, really terrible decision for kids like me, where we can either disconnect ourselves from the things that are really saving us, or we can talk about the abuse and neglect in our own home. I don't think kids should have to make that decision. I think that the child welfare system should recognize the role, the very important role of these extended networks akin.
There's also a whole culture you're writing about here, I mean, it's a culture in crisis, obviously, as you paint it for us, and you do paint it in pretty stark and vivid colors, but also one that that has a great deal of I'm trying to characterize this right because I understand it. emphasis on men acting a certain way, boys acting a certain way in order to be men. In other words, you talk about schoolwork as being effeminate and being sissy, essentially. But also, you know, even later on, you're a respectable citizen, and, you know, you've married up and all the rest of it. You've got a good job and all the rest. Been here with you on this. You know, somebody suddenly cuts you off and you honk your horn and they give you the finger. You want to go after them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in your – it's like B.H. Lawrence said, speaking with your blood. And you want to be a respectable citizen and get control of those kind of feelings. But there they are. They're your demons.
Absolutely. And we talk about honor and dignity a lot in our culture. It's repeated to us and passed down to us through family stories of family violence and vigilante justice. But I think what it ultimately boils down to
Let's go back to McCoys and the...
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a descendant of the Hatfield clan and the famous Hatfield-McCoy dispute. But what it boils down to, I think, is that when you don't have a lot of money, you don't have a lot going materially in your life, your honor and your dignity and your family loyalty are one of the few things that you can really control. So you learn from a very young age to stand up for it and to protect it at all costs. That may make sense, and it may allow you to be resilient and psychologically healthy, reasonably so when you're a 6 or 7 year old poor kid. But when you're in a corporate boardroom or a modern marriage or when you're driving on the street, you've got to give up that sense of honor and loyalty that would drive you to commit violence, because it obviously just doesn't, it doesn't work. It doesn't make for a productive citizen in a modern world.
There's a lot of class resentment here, too. I mean, I don't know how else to characterize it. It's almost as if, you know, we're insiders, everybody else is an outsider, but also resentment against those who are perhaps more patrician, have more landed estates and those sorts of things, but even those who have something, because so many of us have nothing.
Absolutely. It's something that you learn from a very young age, that you mistrust the rich man. As my grandma once said, not all rich people are bad, but all bad people are definitely rich. And there's something about this. It goes back to, frankly, Andrew Jackson, where these poor working class white folks really mistrust the wealthy Americans, those with financial and political power. They perceive that others have that, but they don't. And I think that that's something that I certainly grew up with. And frankly, I think it may explain a fair amount of what's going on in American politics these days.
Well, if you're not to trust a rich man, you have to wonder why so many of these people trust Trump. In fact, I know you've written about that and talked about it, but there's new data that's come out of the Washington Post that says that a study that you might have seen that says that a lot of those with lower incomes or who are more unemployed are not necessarily as legion in number as was once thought in terms of their getting behind Donald Trump.
Yeah, it's that, you know, that study was very interesting and I think shed a lot of light on what's going on with the Trump phenomenon. I think the conclusion of the study was that blue-collar white voters are much more likely to vote for Trump, but it's not purely an economic thing. There are a lot of other reasons why these folks are supporting Trump. And I think that, you know, it's something that I write in the book at great length, is that this isn't just about economic anxiety or economic deprivation. There is a real sense of social isolation, of the whole world around you falling apart, of losing your optimism and your faith in the American dream, rising mortality rates, rising addiction rates. And I think they all combine into this sense that the world just isn't working in some fundamental way. And it breeds a resentment at those who are perceived to have political power. And frankly, it's the one thing that Trump, I think, really taps into with these voters, is that they hate those with political power, and he seems to hate them too.
It's also not only economic poverty that we're talking about here, but as you point out, a kind of spiritual as well as material poverty. And the churches have to some extent gone into decline. I mean, you talk about people who have faith, strong faith, but they don't necessarily feel they want to be allied with the churches.
Yeah, people talk a lot about their Christian faith, how important it is that they're an evangelical Christian, how devout they are. But if you look at the church attendance numbers, church attendance is increasingly something that's confined to middle and upper income Americans. Lower class folks are not attending church as much as they used to. And even though we have this perception of, you know, Ohio and Kentucky, the South and Appalachia as as the Bible Belt, it's actually increasingly the case that it's a middle class phenomenon of people going to church. And, you know, for if you look at the evidence, church is actually really important in the lives of these communities. And the fact that it's going away, I think, causes and leads to a lot of negative things.
There was an article in the Sunday New York Times by an evangelical Christian who said that the real reason that evangelicals are behind and Southern Baptists and so forth, Trump, when one would think that's counterintuitive, given, you know, he was married three times and, you know, known for his, shall we say, philandering and all the rest of it, that the real reason is because he's come out now as being pro-life, and they don't want someone on the Supreme Court who's not going to be pro-life. I wonder, though, let's talk about the word hillbilly. It is a derogatory term.
It absolutely is a derogatory term, but it's also an insider's term. It's something that my grandma always told me, that we were allowed to call ourselves hillbillies, but if anybody else called us a hillbilly, if an outsider called
us a
hillbilly.
It's like the N-word with black people.
It is similar in a lot of ways, though I think it doesn't have quite the political salience as the N-word. But it's certainly something that we internalize, that we're bothered that other folks call us hillbillies. But we're also, I think, very comfortable, and in some ways it's a term of endearment when we use it amongst ourselves.
And you got a stand-up comic like Jeff Foxworthy talking about rednecks and mm-hmm. making a whole there was an op-ed in a Lexington paper suggesting that you're not a hillbilly and you're criticizing that culture from afar. In other words, maybe, I don't know, there was a friend of mine, Brian Copeland, did a show called Not a Real Black Man. Maybe you're not a real hillbilly now, especially—
Well, it's definitely interesting that I'm more disconnected from the culture than I have been, simply because I live in San Francisco and I have a certain level of material comfort and prosperity in my own life. But at a very fundamental level, these are the folks I grew up around. These are the folks that I still love and identify with most closely. And so, you know, while my life is different in a lot of ways, I do feel an especial amount of kinship with these people, with my people. And I'll tell you that the most common response I've gotten from folks back home is something like the following: thank you for being compassionate about our problems, but thank you for being honest about our problems.
And maybe thank you for being one of us and identifying with us. I'm sure that played into their response too.
Sure.
So they're reading your book.
Yeah, people are definitely reading my book back home. It's been one of the most interesting and gratifying experiences is that folks are reaching out, folks I haven't talked to in a while, or people I don't even know, and telling me that they see a lot of their own life in my story. And of course, I'm very happy to hear from them.
Of course, they also might like being called the toughest people in the world, which you do describe them as being, but also the most pessimistic. You want to stand by that?
Yeah, that's definitely true. If you look at the public polling, I think this is again one of the things that's at the root of Trump's appeal. It's not pure economic deprivation. It's this pessimism. It's this belief that the future is going to be bleaker than the past. That's very unique and very exclusive to white working class voters.
And there's also what you write about as ACEs. This is not a term I was aware of, but adverse childhood experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that, from your perspective, not only personally in your own experience, but also throughout the culture, is rampant, ubiquitous.
Yeah. If you look at the data, or if you look at my experience, it's pretty clear that folks like me are more exposed to childhood trauma. There's a great doctor who's written about this, Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, who's in this area. And what she's found is that this childhood trauma, it becomes an intergenerational problem. So parents who expose their kids to childhood trauma, to yelling, to beating, to punching, their kids in turn expose their own children to these problems. And of course, when you grow up in a traumatic home, you're less likely to do well in school, you're more likely to go to jail, and more likely to suffer from other problems too.
Again, we're talking to J.D. Vance. He's the author of Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and a culture in crisis. He's also a principal at Mithril Capital Management, LLC, and we invite you to join the program with any questions or comments you might have. You can do that now by calling our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Again, we're talking about the plight of America's white working class. I know there are many listeners who may want to join in the conversation, so you can do that by calling us now, 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment. Or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Please feel free to join the program. We'll go to your calls and emails when we return. Again, our guest, J.D. Vance, his book, Hillbilly Elegy. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with J.D. Vance. He's the author of Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and a culture at crisis. He also presently is a principal at Mithril Capital Management, LLC. And here's a story from a listener named Paul who writes, thank you for writing your book. You sound like many minority students who attend elite colleges. Yes, they get admitted, but they never quite fit in. These are institutions where upper-class families often send their children to finish their education, but more importantly, to get social training. Minorities have made it, if by getting into these schools, but never quite fit in. This is where I learned that the hardest part about social mobility isn't money. It's learning how to fit in. So for people like me, I'm on the outside while being inside. And the book reminds me that while this country doesn't like minorities, it has even more contempt for poverty and poor people. This is something I struggle with the rest of my life. Good luck navigating your path. I mean, sort of saying it like it is, isn't it? I mean, is it tougher actually for social mobility to kind of adapt yourself to living with the bourgeoisie as opposed to the economics?
I really appreciate that story and definitely agree with his point, which is that ultimately it's more a test of social belonging a lot of times than it is of having a certain amount of money. That was certainly my experience. And it's interesting that, you know, he mentioned, I assume based on the letter that he's a minority. My very best friend at Yale, of course, other than my wife, of course, is a Black Canadian who grew up in pretty poor neighborhood in Toronto. And I think that we both shared a lot of the same feelings about this place, that it was this incredible opportunity, but that we also felt like cultural outsiders in a very important way.
You make distinctions, though, between your white working class impoverished background and, as you did it initially, you know, Black Hispanic working class,
sure,
et cetera. Here's a question from Pete, who tweets, yesterday the radio host Hugh Hewitt tweeted that if Trump wins, J.D. Vance's book explains why. Hewitt says it's apolitical, though. Can you comment?
Yeah, well, it's fundamentally not about the 2016 election. I think I'm making a much longer term and hopefully more important point than what is just happening with the 2016 election. And that's that these white working class voters feel left behind, are increasingly socially isolated, and are in many ways becoming a pessimistic tribe unto themselves. What Donald Trump has tapped into, of course, is a lot of that anger and that frustration, and a lot of that feeling that people like the folks I grew up around are disconnected from those with financial and political power. Trump has really, really tapped into these voters, and I think that if he ultimately wins, it will be because of that, though I have to say I don't think he's going to win.
Well, there's irony to that, though. I mean, you know, I'm thinking about, it's funny, what's flashing through my consciousness is a play that opened up a lot of doors in England called Look Back in Anger, about Jimmy Porter, who was a working class kid, blue collar, and had all this resentment against those with wealth. But Trump, you know, who could be more of a silver spoon candidate than Trump, except maybe George W. Bush?
Well, what Trump does, I think, very successfully is he downplays his wealth. And, you know, we see the way that he conducts himself, the way that he talks about politics, and we say he's being unsophisticated or offensive, and he certainly is. But what he's also being is relatable. If you talk about politics around a blue-collar kitchen table, there's something eminently relatable about how unscripted and off the cuff that Donald Trump is. It's interesting, you know, the last candidate to really, I think, tap into the working-class white vote was, of course, Bill Clinton, who was elite and wealthy in his own way, but he downplayed that, right? He had this classic Southern accent. He didn't talk about his Yale Law School education. I think what it shows is that a lot of this relatability comes down to more how you conduct yourself and how you present yourself, because there just aren't that many people like us in the political sphere to begin with, so the bar is pretty low.
Well, Bill Clinton was somewhat more lower middle class, though, I mean, in terms of his upbringing.
Certainly, certainly.
Let me bring in some callers here, and let's begin, Peter, with you. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Since these people, like your community, are feel so oppressed economically and they resent rich people and all, why do you think that the ideas of Bernie Sanders didn't gain more traction?
Well, I think part of it is just, you know, what I'll call mood affiliation. So people naturally gravitate towards their group and their tribe. And I think that these white working class voters for a very long time have identified very closely with the Republican Party. And so it was always going to be a little bit hard in a single election to get them to vote for a very progressive, democratic socialist. But I will say that I heard a lot of good things said about Bernie Sanders in my community back home, even from people who weren't ultimately going to support him. So I do think that he tapped into a little bit of that frustration, even though he didn't earn a ton of their support.
When I interviewed Bernie Sanders, it was right around the time that he announced that he was going to run for the presidency. And I said, what do you think is a bigger obstacle for you, being a socialist? And of course, he, just like you, codified that into democratic socialist, or being a Jew. And he said, by far, socialist, because Americans don't trust socialists. A lot of them don't trust Jews either, but they particularly don't trust socialists. And that word carries all kinds of weight and all kinds of, I suppose, adversity in terms of the feelings about it. But so, for some reason, in the region you're writing about, does Hillary Clinton. I mean, there's a lot of this pro-Trump feeling is just enmity against Hillary Clinton.
That's definitely true. And a big part of that comes, ironically enough, even though Hillary Clinton, her background is relatively similar to a lot of these white working class voters, she's really constructed her life in a way that feels pretty alien to these people, right? So she's, you know, Ivy League educated. She spent her entire life among the upper crust people that she went to school with and that she spends her time with. And I think most importantly, there's a sense that Hillary Clinton is part of a political machine where people who are wealthy pay for political power. I think that's really damaged her. I think, you know, frankly, if the Democrats had nominated Joe Biden, I don't think that Donald Trump would be getting quite the support among the white working class vote, because it is not so much a supportive feeling towards Trump as it is a negative feeling towards Hillary Clinton.
Well, how much that negative feeling has to do culturally with misogyny? I mean, there's a whole good article I read about how Hillary Clinton inspired a lot of dislike, enmity, hatred even at first because she was trying to be, people perceived her as ideologically part of the feminist movement. You know, she didn't want the name Clinton and she said, I'm not going to bake cookies, all those kinds of things turned a lot of people hostile. And later on, it became, you know, corporate cash and big money for speeches and all the rest of that, lack of trusting. So this particular article said it's different forms of misogyny, really.
Well, I think it's pretty complicated. I'm sure that there are elements of misogyny that go into the white working class enmity towards Hillary Clinton. But I do think that there's also a legitimate sense of alienation from folks like her. I think there's a sense that she doesn't care about what they do or how they live their lives. You know, there was this famous moment where she went to coal country and said that she wanted to put a lot of coal miners and coal businesses out of business. She meant that very well. She was talking about bringing in better jobs, green jobs. But for people who feel very proud about the work that they do in the coal mines, who feel that coal really powers the country, I think that it just feels very culturally disconnected. So I think it's complicated. So I don't think that misogyny has nothing to do with it. But I also think that we'd be doing ourselves a disservice if we thought that was all of what's going on.
I'm reading a comment here by David who says, I heard an earlier interview with Mr. Vance, a conservative who doesn't support Trump but won't vote for Clinton either. Though both Ms. Clinton and Mr. Vance had poor mothers in Ohio. Actually, Hillary's was in Illinois, not far away. He said he can't relate to Hillary because she became a member of the elite by attending fancy schools in the East. Of course, both of them went to Yale Law School, so I guess he evaded the elite epithet by going into business instead of politics?
No, that's a very fair comment from whoever wrote that. But it's not that I feel somehow that I've chosen a less culturally foreign path than Hillary Clinton. What I think that I've tried to do is maintain a little bit of connection to my roots. When you live in these areas and you see the few people who are upwardly mobile, there are really come in two varieties. There are those who seem desperate to get out, desperate to get away from the people they came from. And there are those who seem to want to have some attachment and want to stay at least culturally connected to the places they came from. Clinton has always struck a lot of people as the sort of person who just wanted to join the elite and wanted to forget the past. And hopefully that's not me. But of course, I do get some criticism that I'm now an outsider because I live in San Francisco. So I don't think it's entirely possible to immunize yourself against those charges.
It's also going to be very difficult to stay connected to your roots, especially as the years go by.
That's definitely true. It's something that I think requires a lot of deliberate action, and hopefully I'll be more successful at it than others. But I'm certainly realistic about the fact that it won't be easy.
And you going to vote for the Libertarian?
I really don't know who I'm going to vote for. I'll probably, you know, I think this guy Evan McMullen sounds like a nice guy, got a good head on his shoulders. He has no chance of winning, unfortunately. But it's going to be hard for me to politically pull the lever for Hillary Clinton, even though I think she's ultimately a good person with a good temperament. And I just can never vote for Donald Trump.
We're seeing some numbers going as high as a third, possibly voting for other than the two main candidates because they are both held in such, shall we say, disrespect. Let me get more of our callers on. Liam, morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. My question is about struggles that you, Mr. Vance, might feel being away from your upbringing and your people. And I was wondering if you could quickly talk about, you know, some of the struggles that are exclusive to those that are, you know, in the community day in and day out, and then maybe some of the struggles that you felt that have been with you all along and continue.
Well, the struggle that is most important to me, I think, day to day as I live my own life, or maybe this was true more a couple of years ago than it is today, but is just learning how to conduct myself as I write in the book in a modern 21st century marriage. I think that the childhood I grew up in left a lot of scars, and I had to figure out, I think, how to be a better spouse, how to be a better partner, how to not lose my temper as easily as I did. But you know, most of the struggles, I think, for my day-to-day life these days are pretty mild. It's mostly about not quite fitting in, not quite knowing how to conduct myself in certain social circumstances. But you lose that over time, and I've been lucky, I think, to have a lot of good friends and mentors who have took me under their wing and made sure I knew what I was doing so I didn't look like a total idiot.
But you're going to get the experience of people asking you, you know, are you from Martha's Vineyard or that sort of thing? I mean, you get to the point where you're passing, really, and it almost drops all away in terms of your class background. Speaking personally, obviously. I'm reading some comments here. Here's Leona who tweets, this segment perfectly describes my in-laws and a few other whites who feel overlooked, left behind, and misunderstood. And Karen writes, the parallel book to Hillbilly Elegy is Nancy Eisenberg's White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. Mr. Vance's book describes the experience of the white working class from their point of view. White Trash covers it from an anthropological or sociological point of view, which I think gives a valuable perspective. I speak as someone who came out of the white working class, but not the Appalachian variety. My family came from the Ozarks. Here's Sean, who says, the Democrats have decided to ignore the plights of the working class, to instead focus on identity politics, which is why we're seeing poor white working class people voting for Trump. The left has caused their own problems here. Do you agree with that?
Well, I don't think it's entirely the fault of you know, the political parties, whether Democrat or Republican, that you know, there's been this division between white and minority poor. But I definitely think that there's something a little bit weird going on in our politics where the Republicans seem content to go after just white working class voters. They're making no appeals to black or Hispanic voters. And the Democratic Party seems content to be the cosmopolitan party, to just say, well, we're not going to worry so much about the white working class voter. And that's a real problem because you see increasingly just in the way that we talk about politics these days, Republicans are very bad. They seem to not even appreciate what it feels like to be a black kid living in the inner city, getting harassed by police. And these cosmopolitan Democrats often feel no sympathy towards a blue collar coal miner who's going to support Donald Trump. I think it's a really bad direction for our politics to take. I blame both parties equally, but I also blame, frankly, the people who are voting for him.
Well, Trump seems to have done a quick reversal on immigration, and he has a Hispanic advisor, and a lot of this has come out under new management. I guess he realized that you can't quite deport that many million people. Let me bring some more of our callers on, though. Let me go next to Oakland. Dan, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And thanks for doing the show. I'm calling because basically Mr. Vance's story is an awful lot like my mother's, who also grew up in Ohio in the Rust Belt and also moved out to California, and she went to law school and is extremely upwardly mobile. And I have found throughout my entire life that trying to connect with my poor Scots-Irish relatives, I have continually felt like the kind of outsider he describes in the social workers that tried to help him when he was younger. And I'm wondering if he has any suggestions for me, both personally and also professionally, since I work with a lot of underprivileged communities as a government employee, how to break into that, cross that divide and you know, not be treated as the outsider that I've always felt like I was dealing with my cousins.
That's a very good question. And I think, first of all, you should be commended for trying and for thinking about it, because very few people, I think, recognize that they need to do a little bit of work on that front. The other thing I'll say is that what is most important is just spending as much time with people as possible. It's very hard to understand how folks think, how they act, where they're coming from, unless you spend some time with them. And it's a big problem with the rising rates of residential segregation in this country, that rich and poor, that middle class and working class are just not spending as much time with each other as they used to. And so the only advice I can really offer is to keep trying to understand how they think, but also just spend as much time around these folks as possible, because you'll be amazed what you learn when you do.
And thank you for the call. A lot of your book,
thanks, sir.
is a kind of psychological portrait. There's an emphasis on how people from your region, people who are your kinfolk and everything, back to Hatfields and McCoys, but there's a lot of arguing, there's a lot of use of words as weapons, often, as you point out, to survive, but also tremendously, well, oversensitivity to slights and that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. People, I think, are very proud, and they take their honor and their pride very seriously. And what often that means is that they're willing to go to extreme lengths to defend that honor or to defend that pride. Again, that's maybe makes a little bit sense when you grow up poor and your honor and your pride is all you have. But it doesn't necessarily make a whole lot of sense when you grow up and you have to live in a modern world.
There's a listener named Coco who writes, I'm a Kentucky native. My mom used to tell me to never let anybody call us hillbillies, that we were mountain people. I'm curious about Vance's conservative politics. In a nutshell, do you believe trickle-down economics work?
No, I don't think trickle-down economics do work. And in fact, I think the Republican Party's preoccupation with tax cuts and deregulation, whatever the merits of those policies on their own terms, they ultimately have a limited shelf life in addressing these very complex problems of intergenerational poverty. And one of the things I'd like to see the Republican Party do, the conservative movement do, is think a little bit more constructively and innovatively about how we might help not just the white poor, but the black and Hispanic poor, the poor of all races, because that's what this country really needs right now. We're becoming increasingly a country that is segregated by income and by race. And if our political parties don't do better, especially my party, I don't think that we're going to make much headway in these problems.
It's curious that you should say this in light of some pushback here from a listener named Kelly, and I'll read what she has to say. She says, to me, your guest seems disingenuous. He talks like a scholar and says that he was a hillbilly. He went to Yale. He makes it sound like his culture is the only white culture who has had a hard time. Every immigrant culture struggled. Every immigrant culture has had its addiction and domestic abuse. But those who are white had to have privileges that allowed them to get out of that if they are willing to work for it. It seems like this book is a backlash against black and Latino movements, him saying, oh, I had it bad too.
No, it's definitely not that. And as I say in the introduction, it's really important for me to note that this is not about why white people have it worse than black or Hispanic or any other poor group. In fact, I think those groups have it worse than we do in a lot of ways, in a lot of identifiable, measurable economic ways. But what I think is important is to recognize that this community, despite doing economically better off than the black and Hispanic poor, is struggling in its own unique way. Some of those struggles are self-inflicted. Some of those struggles could be helped by government policy. And if we don't recognize this, we're going to continue to lose those people to political extremists like the one we have who may just become president.
And we bring on more of your calls. We go next to Burlingame. Stan, you're on. Morning.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a couple of comments. I'm a little bit older than the writer, and I grew up in northeastern Indiana. And when I wasn't familiar with the book, and I read the review in the Wall Street Journal, and I started laughing, and I emailed that review to a number of my friends, and I said, if you want to understand me better, read this. My immediate family didn't have the problems with alcoholism and drug abuse, but members of my extended family do, and I'm familiar with it. My mother's from rural Kentucky. My comment is, one thing I've observed, and I've been in this area most of my life, and I understand the disconnect between San Francisco and whether it's Indiana or Kentucky, but I've often observed that my friends here that aren't familiar with that part of the country, there's a complete disconnect, and I almost think that my observation was much earlier was that there's a huge disconnect between the urban educated and those in flyover country, those in places between San Francisco and New York. And the thing that I've observed during this election, and I don't think it gets the attention that it deserves, is that there is real economic hardship for those folks. They're not racist, they're not bigots, but they are desperate financially. And they've gone from, you know, well-paying jobs. There was just an article in the Wall Street Journal last week mentioning a little town in North Carolina where, you know, these folks were making $60,000 15 years ago. Now they're making $40,000. And I have family members who've experienced that. And I do think there's a huge disconnect. And I think until we get and the two political parties aren't addressing that at all, but I do understand the frustration. And I'm always it's interesting to me that my friends in San Francisco, for whom, you know, they're paying $40,000 for their kids' high school tuition, don't get the desperation of families living on $30,000 a year.
J.D. Vance. I think we're getting the gist of what you have to say here, J.D. Vance.
Yeah. Well, it's a very, very important point. I mean, look, the number of comments that I've gotten from relatively wealthy, almost exclusively white, primarily left of center Americans, that when I write about these issues and why somebody might be sympathetic to Donald Trump, I've gotten a lot of, well, those dumb hillbillies, those dumb racist rednecks are going to get what they deserve. He's the candidate that appeals to all of their worst qualities, and he's exactly what they deserve. There's an amazing lack of compassion for so much of the country for the very legitimate problems that the caller just mentioned, but also problems like I write about in the book, you know, from addiction to family breakdown. And if we can't be at least compassionate to the folks who are suffering from these problems, we're going to give them up to the people that we hate. And whether that's Donald Trump or whether that's a candidate 4, 8, 12 years from now, we've got to keep these voters engaged. We've got to keep these people engaged, both because it's good for them and ultimately it's good for a lot of our political conversation.
You ever give any thought to running for public office?
I've certainly given a lot of thought to it. In the past 3 or 4 weeks, because a lot of people have asked me, but before then, I can't say I thought much about it. I'm very happy where I am, and I think that there are ways for me to contribute, hopefully, to this conversation that don't involve throwing my hat into a very crazy circus ring.
Well, you made a prediction earlier. You said you didn't think Donald Trump would be the next president of the United States. You want to make a prediction about our home state? We're both from Ohio. How do you think it's going to go?
I think Hillary Clinton will win Ohio by a comfortable but not a gigantic margin.
Of course, we're omitting the possibility of what they call an October surprise in this election, aren't
sure.
we? Let me get another caller in here, though. Keith joins us next. Keith, you're on.
Yes. Hello, Mr. Vance. I am not a member of the Scotch-Irish working class, but I grew up in a town where a lot of the people had moved north as they did in your case, but they had moved west to New Mexico. So I can talk like them when I want to, because they're the folks I grew up around. My question for you, though, is...
J.D. sounds like a Yankee when he goes back there, though. I
don't know. Curious. My question, though, is, in my opinion, basically the Scotch-Irish working class has been exploited, poorly treated, misled, betrayed, for brief periods, for the last 300 years. So my question for you would be, what would the best ways to either help these folks or allow them to help themselves?
Well, I think we would start by thinking about what are the areas that these folks are living in, what are the jobs that they are unable to get, and how can we retrain them for a modern 21st century economy. We talk a lot about four-year education, but we don't talk as much about vocational education that might give these folks a better opportunity at a decent wage without some of the expense and, frankly, the skills that a lot of people don't have in communities where folks didn't grow up in a great high school. It's really hard to go to a four-year university. But I also think we'd think, you know, to talk about family policy and how to improve family policy, how to give kids who grow up in abusive and neglectful homes more access to their extended kin network instead of sticking them in a foster home with a stranger. There are many other things we could do, but I think it starts with a recognition of the unique type of challenges these folks are facing. And I think a lot of good ideas would flow from that recognition.
And we thank you for the call. Here's Edward, who writes a little bit of a puzzling comment. We'll see what you make out of it, J.D. He says, interesting, because the dynamic for poor white folk is the same dynamic black folk have always had to deal with. But for black folk, lack of opportunity is an excuse. But for white folk, it's a reason.
Well, I'm not quite sure I understand the comment, but I'll try to take a stab at it. I think that there is a perception that's very legitimate that we've talked about these cultural problems among the black community for the past 30, 40 years, and we typically use it as what I'll call weaponized sociology. We talk about all the bad things that are true about black people. We talk about all the pathologies that they have, and we never stop to really think about what it's like to grow up in a poor black community. We've never stopped to examine whether there are similar problems in poor white communities and whether there may also be similar criticisms to levy there. And I think that what I hopefully am doing with this book is adding to the conversation, getting folks to recognize that these problems do exist in poor white communities. But hopefully one of the offshoots of that should maybe be a little bit more compassion to the black poor who folks have maligned for a very long time.
Well, there's also, despite all that maligning, black folks themselves and some outsiders who have made us increasingly aware of the things that you bring into the mix here. I mean, the importance of family and how loving and how devoted to faith and how, you know, in many ways virtuous and hardworking many segments of both populations are. And one has to obviously bring that into the equation. And we'll bring in another caller. Hank, that's you. Welcome.
Yeah, hi. That's exactly the point I was calling about, is I kind of think that one of the crisis points in this community that the author is writing about is that they never had an identity. There's always been, white people have always been like the dominant culture, so they didn't have to do any self-analysis. That's one of my favorite, one of the things I appreciate about the Black Lives Matter movement over the last couple of years is we're talking about white people and white privilege, but the people that this author is describing really were, they were members of the dominant culture, but they didn't ever have to analyze it.
You know, you bring in an important point, Hank, but it also prompts me to ask, we're talking about Trump support. He's gotten a lot of support from David Duke and those people, and they say, you know, we're white Europeans. That's our identity. We need to be recognized. How do you respond to that?
Well, the caller makes a very important point here, which is that a lot of these folks haven't found their identity in their race. They find it in their class. They find it in the areas where they grow up in. They find it in being rural or being country. And it is true that for the past 10 years, the past 5 years even, folks have been really confronted with what whiteness means. And a lot of times they don't like the answer because, frankly, they don't like a lot of the other white people that they get lumped alongside of. I think that, you know, when you're a working class Southern Ohioan, you don't like the idea that you're part of the same social class as Hillary Clinton or as the elites of the Northeast, the people that you really dislike. And so I do think a big part of this story and something we have to think about and tease out a little bit more is what is the role of whiteness and the way that people perceive their own whiteness in driving some of these problems. I unfortunately don't have a very good answer.
Well, we'll leave it there. We may talk about it certainly in the future. These kind of big questions we like to take up, and I certainly enjoy talking to you. As you said earlier on, you're too young maybe to write a memoir, but you've written really a very fine book, and congratulations on it.
Thank you.
J.D. Vance, the book is Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and a culture in crisis. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, and Susan Britton. By the way, continue this discussion online, kqed.org/forum. Engineer today is Howard Gelman, engagement producer Amanda Stupai, senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. And for all of us at KQED Public Radio, thank you. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.